Tonight I have the pleasure of welcoming Patricia Greenfield to talk on the psychology of reading. Patricia received her PhD from Harvard University and is currently professor of psychology at UCLA, where she is a member of the Developmental Psychology Group. She's a past recipient of the American Association for the Advancement of Science Award for Behavioral Science Research and has received teaching awards from UCLA and the American Psychological Association. She has authored or co-authored, at least according to my count, well over 100 papers. And her books, among her many books include Mind and Media, the Effects of Television, Video Games, and Computers, which has been translated, I think, into at least 8 or 9 languages. Interacting with Video, Cross-Cultural Roots of Minority Child Development, and Weaving Generations Together, Evolving Creativity and the Maya in the Maya of Chiapas. Among many other projects, she has done field research on child development and socialization in Chiapas, and currently heads the Children's Digital Media Center at Los Angeles. In 2010, she won the Yuri Bronfenbrenner Award for Lifetime Contribution to Developmental Psychology in the Service of Science and Society. She was a founding member of the FPR UCLA Center for Culture, Brain, and Development. Patricia's central theoretical research interest lies in the relationship between culture and human development. This broad field of inquiry has found diverse manifestation in her work, from research on how cultural values influence relationships on multi-ethnic high school sports teams, to cross-cultural teacher training, to a study on evolving conceptions of creativity among Chiapas weavers. This last study, by the way, produced a beautifully photographed book, which we have for sale tonight at the back, and it's a special discounted price of $20 just for tonight. And another major manifestation of her research has been an inquiry into the effects of media on the mind. And this interest is naturally intersects with Scanner's interest in the materiality of the printed book and the reading and browsing experience engendered by the specific material medium. So my idea for programming this talk on the psychological implications of reading came from two main sources. The first is Walter Ong's amazing book on orality and literacy, in which he writes about writing as a technology that radically changed not only our culture, but our how we experience our subjectivity. And the second source was this sort of incessant drumbeat of reports on the rise of the ebook and the death of the book, and also our general turn to the computer screen for our reading texts. And so I wondered, putting these two ideas together, if this new kind of reading that most of us engage in a lot, so on screen and online as opposed to on paper, might somehow be changing our brains and behavior in a shift analogous to that change that happened when we changed from oral culture to a literate culture. So searching online on this topic led me to an article that Patricia had written about the types of cognitive skills that are produced when or exercised when using different types of media. And after an email exchange with her, I realized that actually the more general question of what exactly do we know from a psychological standpoint about how reading affects our neural, cognitive, and social experience. And so that became the genesis of the talk tonight. And so I take it that as with many questions about the mind today, there is a lot that we don't know, probably more that we don't know than we know. But tonight we have the pleasure of discovering some of what we do know about this fascinating subject. Please join me in welcoming Patricia Greenfield.
Thank you very much, Nick. That was a great introduction. And congratulations to both of you on this project, which is really wonderful. Yeah, I think we should be clapping. Definitely. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be in this new environment and with all of the cross-fertilization. So I'm going to talk this afternoon about how reading affects your brain and behavior. I saw this place as kind of an integration of art and science, so hence the painting that I had commissioned for this cover slide, first slide. So reading as a medium has both benefits and costs. And it has benefits and costs for both brain and the behavior, and behavior. And I'm going to start with the brain. So I'm going to talk about how learning to read changes cortical networks. This is a very recent article from Science Magazine, and you'll see that the two neural studies are both very, very recent. It's only in the last couple of years we've really known anything about this topic. Now, okay. Don't freak out if you're not a scientist. I spent a lot of time trying to make this understandable for people who know nothing about the brain and maybe nothing about psychology. So this particular study is an fMRI study. And fMRI stands for functional magnetic resonance imaging. And what fMRI does is it allows you to see a brain response, actually it images blood flow in the brain, which indexes brain activity during actual activities. And that's why you have the F, it's for functional. MRI without the F just looks at brain structure, not brain function. I'm going to talk briefly about an MRI study as well. Okay, so in this study, this is what I call a natural experiment. Can you see? Okay. In a natural experiment, you compare groups that were defined by nature rather than by the manipulation of the researcher. And I'm extremely fond of natural experiments, and this is a really fabulous one. So here are the groups. The LB... one group, literates, the green line, which you'll see in a number of graphs that will come up subsequently. The B stands for Brazil, the L stands for literate. This is a group where they acquired literacy the way I'm sure everybody in this room acquired literacy, by going to school as children. The LP group, the next one down, the blue or purple line, are the L again stands for literate. They acquired literacy in childhood in the same way. The P stands for Portugal, so they were recruited from Portugal. And then the LB2 group, actually I'm going to come back to them because they are more relevant to one of the later groups. Then the turquoise line, what they call exilliterates, the EXB group, that's exilliterates from Brazil. But exilliterates, I think this is a horrible name, but I couldn't change the graph. So these are people who gained literacy in adulthood. I would call them adult literates as opposed to child literates. And then, so the turquoise group were recruited from Brazil. The red group also acquired literacy as adults, and they were recruited in Portugal. And then you have what they called the illiterates, those people who at the time they were tested, didn't know how to read or write, maybe will never know how to read and write. But they were adults who didn't read and write. And they were from a low socioeconomic status, as you can imagine, also from Brazil. And they are matched for socioeconomic status with the LB2 group, the Brazilian literates who are from who did learn to read and write. That's the olive line. They did learn to read and write in childhood, but they're from the same, they were matched for socioeconomic status with the illiterates. So, okay, don't freak out at the graph. So I've introduced you to the groups, this is a graph that shows the effect of reading. Oh, you know what? One other thing that I didn't tell you, that the order of those groups here, from the green literates down to the purple illiterates, is the order of actual reading competence, which was tested in the study. And in order to create that order, in other words, the researchers didn't just rely on the information that I've given you, the background information. They actually tested them, each person in the study. And on the basis of that, those tests, they put them in this order, which is exactly what you would have expected, the order of reading skill based on the background information. But I just want to tell you a little bit about what tests they gave. It was a composite of tests of letter identification, you know, recognizing letters, word reading, and sentence reading. Okay, so that was the order in which the order of reading skill. Okay, so. This graph, each of the graphs I'm going to show you has to do with the response to differential reading skill in different areas of the brain while in the fMRI scanner. Let's see. The vertical axis is the amount, it's some kind of a scale of the amount of neural response. And then the horizontal axis, where you see three points, checkers, spoken, which is spoken sentences, and written, which is written sentences, that's the brain response when presented with checkers were moving checkerboards. You can present visual things in the fMRI scanner. Spoken was presentation of spoken sentences, and written was presentation of written sentences. So the spoken sentences would be, you know, auditory, and the written sentences, of course, would be visual, and the checkers would also be visual. The participants in the study didn't have to do anything. They were just viewing or hearing these stimuli. Okay. So the vertical axis is a scale of brain activation at particular sites in the left frontal cortex. Okay, that's why it says left frontal. The left frontal cortex just generally doesn't respond to visual stimuli like moving checkerboards. The left frontal cortex is activated normally by spoken language. In other words, this part of the brain is responsible for processing spoken language. If it's damaged, people have problems with spoken language, as in certain kinds of aphasia. So the left frontal cortex is a key area for language, especially speech planning or complex speech. So as you can see, there were no group differences in response to spoken sentences, nor was there group difference in response to checkers. But as you can see, because this is a language area, there's very little response in any group to the visual stimulus of the checkers, the checkerboards, and there's a lot of response in all the groups to spoken sentences. So the groups aren't different, but you can see the you can see the function of the left frontal area of the cortex in terms of the fact that it doesn't respond to visual stimuli and it does respond to spoken language. Okay, but then look at now the response in these same areas to written sentences. And you see the groups are very different. That's the points on the right-hand side of the graph. So the left frontal cortex of the three childhood literacy groups are the most activated by seeing written sentences. Those are the green and blue points. And also, the green and blue points. Next, you have the groups who acquired literacy in adulthood. Those are the turquoise and the red points. They have less response in this area to the written sentences. And finally, with basically no brain activation of the left frontal cortex, you have the illiterates, the purple. So the results with the left frontal cortex show that higher levels of reading skill recruit and augment activity in the speech areas of the brain. So that's the first pattern. Okay. Now we have another one. This is the occipital cortex. The occipital cortex is the area of the cortex of the brain that is specialized to respond to visual stimuli. So it has a different function. And you can kind of see that because look how high now the checker's response is. And it's high basically in all the groups. And then, and that's these here. And then look how little response there is to the same, these are the same stimuli, to the spoken sentences in all the groups. No. But again, now you have differentiation of the groups in terms of response to written sentences. So the written sentences activate the visual cortex, the occipital cortex, the most for childhood literates in both countries. The Brazilian ex-literates, adult literates, and the low SES, low socioeconomic status literates are next. And then the least activation by written sentences is seen in the brains of the illiterates down here. Okay. So this graph shows that reading also recruits the visual cortex. We've seen that it uses the language areas of the cortex, but it also recruits the visual cortex and produces more visual response the higher the level of reading skill. The results also suggest a connection to socioeconomic status because the ex-illiterates in Brazil, the turquoise point on the right, show more activation than do the low socioeconomic status, childhood literates, the olive green point on the right, who are also from low socioeconomic status. Okay, last graph, promise you. So this one has to do with another area. So far we've dealt with areas that were specialized before reading ever evolved in human culture for things that were not reading. In the one case for spoken language or language, in the other case for visual stimuli. But this is an area, the VWFA, which stands for visual word form area. This is an area that is specialized for reading words. And again, the vertical axis is a scale of brain activation at certain sites, this time in the visual word form area. So you can see that in no group does this area respond very much either to the visual checkerboard patterns or to spoken sentences. But in all the literate groups, the visual word form area responds to written sentences to at least some degree, except the illiterate group, the purple dot here. And note that the three childhood literacy groups who also went to school, that's another way in which they differ from people who became literate in adulthood who do it without going to school. And the three childhood literacy groups show the most response. Those are these three up here. So this graph shows that reading skill recruits and enhances activity in the reading area of the brain, probably the least surprising of all the findings that I've shown you so far. But there's something interesting about that area nonetheless, which is clearly that was not always that area was not always specialized for reading because our brains haven't changed all that much since reading was developed in human culture and our human brains were basically evolved years and years, thousands of years, even millions of years before reading evolved. So this area, the visual word form area, also plays an important role in responding to faces and other visual stimuli. And that was probably its original function, which started long before reading evolved. So researchers of this study had a hypothesis they called the competition hypothesis, and that is that there would be decreased neural response to other visual stimuli, that is, other than reading stimuli, other than words and sentences, with an increase in reading performance. And in fact, they did find a significant decrease in the neural response to faces in this area and in several other brain areas as reading skill increased. By reading skill increased, we mean from group to group to group. In other words, the earlier you learn to read, the worse your brain response, or the lower your brain response in this area would have been to would have tended to be to faces. And this decrease in neural responses to faces was larger than the response, than the decreased response to any other visual stimulus. It seemed also that early, in terms of the pattern of results, that early schooling and early literacy versus compared with adult acquired literacy had a big effect on reducing neural response to faces in the in this area. So there seemed to be a cost here of neural response to human faces as a result of or correlated with an increase in reading skill. In other words, the idea there would be now this area is being focused on reading and it has less, fewer connections available to focus on and respond to human faces. But these losses, these costs, were counterbalanced by increased neural responding to faces in some other areas of the brain, as well as a shift from responding, the left hemisphere responding to the right hemisphere responding to faces in the visual cortex. The net result was that literates had more brain regions that were more differentiated by function. In other words, that visual word form area, rather than being used for both faces, visual stimuli, and reading, now was used more for reading, but then some other areas became more specialized for responding to faces. Nonetheless, the authors of the study say that they will explore in future research, quote, the intriguing possibility that our face perception abilities suffer in proportion to our reading skills. So let me summarize this study. The results with the left frontal cortex, which is a key area for language, especially speech planning or complex speech, show that reading recruits and augments activity, neural activity, in the speech areas of the brain. The results with the occipital cortex, which is specialized for visual stimuli, show that reading also recruits visual cortex and produces more visual response the higher the level of reading skill. The results with the visual word form area show that reading skill enhances activity in the reading area of the brain, competing successfully with its face processing function to reduce this area's neural response to faces. However, other brain areas increase their response to faces with increasing levels of reading skill. So it remains to be seen from future research whether reading has an overall negative effect on the response to human faces. Let me now just speak briefly about a study of the effects of reading on brain anatomy, because so far we've been looking at brain function, but brain function is supported by brain anatomy. So this was another interesting study that was a natural experiment. This was done in Colombia, South America, and it's a study comparing what they called late literates, which are the adult literates, what the other study called ex-literates. I like late literates a lot better than ex-illiterates. Late literates better, more positive than ex-illiterates. So they compared late literates with a matched set of illiterates in Colombia. And the background was that the reason they could get such a sample was that this was published in 2009, and when they started the study, guerrillas who have been fighting for years and even decades in Colombia were reintegrating into Colombian society. But this was their first opportunity opportunity to learn to read in their late 20s. They had never had an opportunity to go to school, so it's another natural experiment. So this study involved MRI scans, that's magnetic resonance imaging without the F, not the function. This is looking at brain structure. And what they found was that the late literates had more gray matter compared with the illiterates in five brain regions that had formerly in other studies been identified as regions that are activated during reading. So, okay, well, what is gray matter? Gray matter are the cell bodies and their connecting elements that are responsible for functions like speaking, visual perception, and reading. They are the anatomical basis for the brain functions that I was talking about in the other study. So basically, what this study shows is that that reading not only affects brain function, but it also affects neural anatomy. So what are the implications of these studies? First implication, reading sculpts human brain function. But I want to emphasize the second point, so does every experience. Nothing special about reading in that way. Every experience strengthens certain brain connections or functions and affects an anatomical development. Another way of putting this is that our brains adapt to new behavioral functions through learning processes, and this is the hallmark of the human species. These learning processes, including learning to read, leave traces in brain anatomy which supports brain function. The real question about functional changes brought about by reading is whether there is a cost to other functions, particularly the important social function of responding to the human face. Because reading also leads to enhancement of function in other neural areas in response to faces, that is to brain differentiation, the answer to this question remains for future research. But there's also, I think, an interesting question as to whether increased brain differentiation makes psychological integration more difficult for us. A question that we can talk about and think about, but we can't really answer at this point. Okay, so that's everything about effects of reading on the brain that I'm going to talk about, and now I'm going to go into effects of reading on behavior, talking about first cognitive processes and then social behavior. So first cognitive processes. Okay, here's a kind of summary of what I'm going to say here. Reading is associated with reflection. It stimulates creativity and it enhances critical thinking. How do we know this? I'm going to tell you about a study of reflection in first grade students. I'm going to analyze what happens when a book is made into a film, go on to a study of creativity in seventh graders, and then a study of critical thinking in freshman college students. And in all of these, look at the effects of reading. So first, the study of reflection in first grade students. Okay, so this is a study by Kagan, was published in 1965, and he developed a test of impulsivity and reflection. The task here, and this is just a sample stimulus, is to find the shape that matches the top tree. So impulsive first graders do this kind of problem very quickly, and they make lots of errors. Reflective first graders do it slow and make few errors. And the finding that I found interesting for present purposes is that the better readers in first grade were more reflective. But let's try to get the answer, because I think you will kind of see what's involved. Who knows what the answer is? You could shout it out. Yeah. That's right. The top row, the middle one. That's exactly right. So in terms of this test, Kagan defined reflectiveness operationally here as thinking about alternatives. You have to carefully compare every single one of those six trees in the bottom two rows with the one at the very top. Now let me analyze in the light of this idea about this quality of being reflective, what happens when a book is made into a film. And the book that I just going to use as an example is Being There by Jerzy Kaczynski. And I would like to compare it with the movie of Being There. Has anybody ever seen or read the book? Few people have. Okay. Well, an important part of the book is made up of the thoughts of the main character, whose name is Chance. The film version, however, uses a TV screen. He's kind of addicted to television. So the film version uses the TV screen to show what Chance is watching, but the film is unable to portray the subtleties of what he is thinking. So film is forced to portray internal thought through external action. What are the implications of this? Well, I think the implications are that books are unique in providing role models of internal thought. This may be one way in which they foster reflective thought. I mean, even if you haven't read that book, I'm sure you've read many books in which the thought processes of the characters are described, but that can't be done in film. So that may provide a model for people who are reading of reflective thought, because they're reading about characters who are thinking and they're finding out what they're thinking. Another reason why reading may be favorable and develop reflective thought is that the book, and I think this is extremely important, is not a real-time medium. It does not, unlike a film or an action video game, it does not pace you or rush you. Unlike television or video games, you can go at your own pace. Okay, well, what about some other cognitive effects, and what about some other age groups? The first study was about first graders. So now I'm going to move to a study of creativity in seventh graders. And this is a study of imagination or creativity. Seventh graders were divided into two groups. One group saw educational films about four social problems. That was called the video group. Another group read about the same social problems. In other words, we call that the print group, because they got the same information but through print. One problem that was presented in these materials was about developing new ideas for recycling waste materials. And then the film and the print materials presented sample solutions. For example, the film showed used tires being tossed into a giant incinerator and burned to create power in a British factory. And then the print materials presented the film narration of this happening. Then afterwards, the children were told that what they had seen or what they had read, depending on the group, was one approach to the particular problem. For example, the recycling problem. And then they were asked to think of and write down what the researchers called the best, most original idea you can think of. And then they scored their answers. And they were scored for two features of creativity. So in essence, this is how, for their purposes, the researchers defined creativity. The first feature they called freedom from the stimulus. And that was scored as being present if the response went off in directions not indicated by the question and used facts and concepts not present in the given information. The second feature was called transformation, and that was scored as present if the response created new forms, new terms, new categories, was appropriate to the problem, and also stimulated more ideas, more thinking, and had heuristic value. So, the results. First, the quantitative results, then I'm going to give you an example of the results. The possible solutions developed by the print group showed more freedom from the stimulus than those developed by the video group, and this difference was statistically reliable. In addition, the possible solutions developed by the print group showed the quality of transformation more frequently than those developed by the video group. That's a PowerPoint mistake. Hopefully not too confusing to you. So in other words, the print, those children who had seen the problems presented in print had more freedom from the stimulus in their responses and more of the transformational quality. And here's an example of freedom from the stimulus in the print group contrasted with somebody from the video group whose response does not show that quality. So this seventh grader who had seen the problem presented in print responded to the prompt by saying, "To get fuel from something useless, you can use teeth. Since people have stopped using Crest, there are 99% more cavities than 10 minutes ago. That means that we have so many teeth in the world, it's getting impossible. People's houses are becoming filled with dog teeth, cat teeth, all kinds of teeth. You put all the teeth in a big pot, melt them, and add all the dead rats in the gutters you can find." And okay, so that freedom from the stimulus contrasted with this child who saw it in video. Old chewed up bubble gum, if washed and compressed properly into 1-inch thick squares of different sizes, could be used as tire patches or patches for other things made of rubber. Once pressed into the tires, it would be grooved to match the tire, thus making it perfectly safe. And this is considered not free from the prior stimulus because, remember, the film showed tires being incinerated to make power. So this is still using tires. And so has less freedom from the stimulus. Okay, now the same thing, an example of transformation where the child who had seen the problem presented in print transformed the problem, and the child who had seen it in video did not. So the print child said, "Ideas are thrown away. They might have helped the world." That is quite a transformation, I think. And then the child who had seen the problem presented on video and the solution said, "Old scrap metal from cars could be used again in new cars and spare parts too, engines, radiators." That's clearly related to what they had seen happening with the recycling of the tires. Okay, so conclusion. From this study, given the same content, the print medium stimulates creativity defined in this way more than the video medium. However, this is a classical definition of creativity, and new media may be stimulating new types of creativity. For example, a postmodern collage type of creativity where you put together, you recycle and you recirculate photos that you've gotten from the internet in new ways, making new kinds of combinations. So it may be not that we have less creativity developed by new media, but different kinds of creativity. However, this classical definition of creativity is what is measured in creativity tests. So it's a very standard type of way of measuring creativity. Okay, so now I want to move to the study of critical thinking in freshman college students. This is a longitudinal study of development of critical thinking during the first year of college. And here's a sample from the test. So A says, "The domestic spending policies of the current administration are simply reprehensible. The real enemy of our democracy is not big government, but big business. As our society becomes increasingly dominated by enormous corporate conglomerates, there's less and less room for real individual initiative. Our lives are becoming completely determined by what happens in the boardroom as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer." B says, "How can you say that? You have it just backwards. Excessive government regulation and high taxes lead to complete totalitarianism. Only when there's less government intervention in our lives and lower taxes allow us to employ our assets to our own best advantage, does talk of individual initiative make any sense at all? A goes, you elitists are all alike. You think only of the freedom of opportunity for the privileged few. You have no concern for those members of society who may not have the resources to be entrepreneurs or investors. Democracy means liberty and justice for all, not just for those of you with a lot of money. I'm reading all of this because this is actually the minimum to get the answer. I left out a lot. Justice, what justice? What justice is there in taking away my hard-earned dollars to pay for welfare programs for people who don't want work? And besides, liberty is simply a question of the existence of possibilities. Everyone can succeed in our society if they only use their talents and assets wisely. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. A responds, you're confusing liberty with license. Having the right to do something doesn't mean that there's any real opportunity for you to actually do it. The least advantaged of our society do not have the ability to exploit the system successfully. Freedom is a matter of choice between real alternatives. Alternatives the poor do not have. Okay, so then the question is, the first question, there are several questions, but this is the sample. What is A's complaint about the current administration's policies? What do you think? Some people said D. Some people said C. Okay. It's C. Okay. So what are the results? So I should mention that tests like these were given at the beginning of freshman year and the end of freshman year to see the progress. And it turned out, what does this have to do with reading? Well, it turned out that the number of non-assigned books read during freshman year was positively related to improvement in critical thinking skills during the year. Non-assigned books means reading for pleasure. That has a lot to do with this bookstore, I think. So what are the implications for society? Well, I see implications for political life. I think that that as reading has declined, newspapers have declined, the public has gone from critical assessment of issues to external image in our political decisions as we've moved from newspaper to TV as major sources of political news and analysis. And in fact, the kind of analysis presented in newspapers, the kind of political analysis is not found at all on TV. Reading for pleasure, definitely. Yeah, there are studies of that. No, I don't. It's a really good question. Probably assigned reading hasn't, you know, in colleges has not declined. Yeah, but that was also a factor that was positively related to improvement in critical thinking skills. I just pulled out reading for pleasure. I'm not sure how they defined it. I cannot answer that question. But probably, well, yeah, they would, because unless the newspaper was assigned, the variable that they were talking about was non-assigned books, actually. But I think, you know, they're very closely related. Okay, let me go on now to social behavior. And here I'm going to talk about a study that was done in the 1960s in Nigeria on the social effect of literacy and reading. In this study done by Mallory Wober, workers in a company could choose between living in a suburban housing development with yards in a quiet residential environment or living in more traditional, crowded, noisy, sociable urban environments with lots of street life. When workers chose the former over the latter, it was often because they wanted to be alone in peace and quiet to read. At that time, literacy and formal schooling were just becoming widespread in Nigeria. So, literacy was the first technology to reduce face-to-face interaction. Now we have social networking and email, etc., that continue this trend. So, I'm going to conclude now. By summarizing, so in terms of effects of reading on the brain, on the neural level, the brain has adapted to reading by augmenting activity in the neural areas dedicated to speech, recruiting areas of the visual cortex to work in the service of reading, enhancing activity in a part of the brain that's come to be known as the visual word form area, and generally, and also changing brain anatomy, more gray area in reading areas. On the behavior level, reading makes our processes, the research seems to show, more reflective, more critical, and more creative in the classical sense of creativity. In terms of social behavior, reading was the first medium to reduce social interaction, but it wasn't the last. And that's all. Now we'll have some discussion.
Have there been any studies about the type of things that people read and how different genres or different types of reading materials?
Do you want me to repeat the questions for your recording?
Yeah.
Okay. So the question was: have there been any neural studies concerned with differentiating the neural effects of different kinds of reading, different genres of reading? Yeah. It hasn't been done. Whether it's coming, I don't know, but probably it will be coming. Yes. Yeah, the question was, are there studies where greater skill is reflected by greater brain efficiency, therefore decreasing activation? There definitely are studies like that. I think that's why it was really important in this study that they actually measured reading skill in the study. So in this study, there is a correlation between activation and reading skill. We know that. Yes, that does happen where you get greater efficiency and therefore there's less brain activation among people who are very highly skilled in something. So, but that's not a possible interpretation of this study because they not only knew the background concerning whether they had learned to read or they hadn't and when, but they also actually measured reading skill in the study. So it was really clear that more activation was going on for the better readers. Yes?
I'm curious about the criterion of independence from the stimulus.
Yeah, I agree with you. The question was independence from the stimulus. Why is that a value? I totally agree, but that was how it was measured in this study. I mean, we could say that maybe reading is causing wild imagination, or print causes wild imagination, and we'd rather have people be more realistic. And that television makes you more realistic. I wasn't really trying to make a value judgment. I was just reporting the results, and I agree. I would say the researchers were making a value judgment in that they really felt that more creativity was better. But they, you know, more freedom from the stimulus was better. Yeah, freedom from the stimulus.
We're talking about simple, independence from the specifics of the stimulus. That is not the same thing as creativity.
Right. I totally agree. The comment was that independence from the stimulus was not the same as creativity. If you buy my book, it actually is about social change in a Maya community over two decades and changing definitions of creativity, where in the early generation, where their economic system was basically subsistence and agriculture, creativity was defined as, in the domain of textile design, as everybody wears something that looks exactly the same, and the creation identifies you as a member of the community, and everybody is the same, because we're all members of the same community. Then, as their commercial economy developed, and they moved from subsistence and agriculture to money and commerce, the creativity became more individuated, variability, innovation. So I see both definitions of creativity as being equally valid, but adapted to different kinds of environments. So I definitely agree with you. Yes.
Can you speak a little bit more about the changing definition?
The question was, could I speak a little bit more about changing definition of creativity? Well, you know, if you look at, I'm not an expert on this, but music, you know, where people are doing sampling and they're putting together stuff rather than coming up with something new, I think that would be an example. People's, you know, profiles on social network sites where they put together pictures and, you know, in different arrangements. Yeah, those are some examples. Yes.
So in one of the studies early on in the talk, you talked about the visual.
Okay, let me see if I can repeat this question. Okay. He's talking about the competition between visual stimuli, response to visual stimuli and response to written stimuli, but they are visual. You know, it's not iconic, but it's visual. In the word form area, and he's a visual artist, and he wants to know if he should stop reading. So I guess in order to enhance the use for other visual things. Well, I don't think reading print enhances visualness, does it? I mean, when I asked the artist, her name is Goldie Salenkund, to do this, I wrote to her. She's in New York, and I said, and she also is a psych major and, you know, knows psychology and has worked with me in psychology. But I said, you know, my topic is reading. I don't think it's very visual. So, but she, you know, she sort of managed. Yeah. So I don't know. What do you think from your own personal experience as a visual artist? Do you think that it hurts you to? I mean, you could look at it the other way too. That in reading versus watching television, you'll come up with all these things because you put in the visual images, right? So I think the question is all of the critical and academic writing about visual art, is that positive for the actual development of visual art or is it negative? Well, I mean, I think it's kind of known that studying history of art doesn't help your creativity in art, or studying, you know, doing film studies as an academic discipline doesn't help your filmmaking ability. So,
but
oh, you mean looking? Oh, well, what were you talking about? Reading or looking? You were talking about reading about it. Yeah, I mean, I think looking. Well, I my daughter is a photographer, as you'll see, a really very, very accomplished one, and. I know that for her, looking was very important. That she sort of felt she was building on photographers that had gone before. Yes.
It should be said that one can't stop reading. You can't.
You're talking about the neural study?
Correct.
Yeah. So the question was, it makes a big difference what you read, which was kind of the first question was, do we know what difference that makes neurally? And then this is the further question of what were the stimuli. The longest stimuli were individual sentences. So it wasn't about reading passages it wasn't about comprehension. I mean, they just put them in front of their eyes. But, you know, as you said, you can't stop reading. And I think that's quite profound in terms of the neural response, because I was thinking about that in terms of the word form area as opposed to the speech area. That's probably kind of whole word recognition that we all develop. You know, we start reading phonetically, but we end up just seeing words. And I think that's probably the word form area, but also that I think that's also might be the significance of the visual cortex, that you end up kind of recognizing these patterns. Yeah, that's true. I will agree with you in that I know children often can like read a stop sign before they can actually read. However, working in a Maya community in Chiapas, Mexico, with a group who have never been to school, I would say that isn't true in that type of an environment, that they cannot probably read even that kind of thing. But living in, you know, living in a village, but living in an urban environment, I think they may develop it. I have one girl who's, that I've known since she was very, very little, a baby, who's now in her about 20, and I know because I was there that she quit school in before, like in kindergarten, in preschool, because she didn't want to go to school. And at that time, only about a third of the girls were going to school, so that wasn't abnormal or anything. But recently, she sent me a text from her phone, and I asked, I thought maybe somebody else was sending the text for her on using her phone, another member of the family. So I texted back to find out, and she said she sent it. And I asked her how she learned, and one of her sisters taught her. And she go, and then she added, "But I can only read in text. That's all I can read." So I think that's kind of an example of what you're talking about. Yeah. Yes. The question was, how do I see pathways being impacted by social media and other computer modalities? Well, I've said I have a graduate student who's working on that, and she's just starting. She's in her second year of graduate school, and she's just planning that study that you're talking about. So we will see. Yes. That's a great interpretation. Okay, the question was, could the fact that reading increases social isolation, you might say, or could that be a reason why you become less sensitive to faces in that area because actually you would have less experience in seeing faces? That really makes a lot of sense. That would be interesting if you could separate it out, but it definitely makes a lot of sense because the same idea that if practice and experience is enhancing the connections and you're getting less practice in seeing faces, and part of that reason you're getting less experience is because of reading, then that would make sense as an implication in effect. Yeah. Yes. Okay, the question was the person asking the question has found, who's I think a high school teacher, that if you read, you can have really great discussions, and that students who read have and people who read, you have better discussions with. And so she doesn't want to think that reading makes you less social. I think you're talking more about quality rather than quantity, and this was really about quantity. But I think it does, I think it does have some educational implications that maybe interpersonal discussions would be a really good outcome of reading assignments in class rather than keeping it all to yourself. But in fact, what often happens in school, as I remember, is you read and then maybe you write a book report and there isn't discussion. So I think there are educational implications for all of these things. And, you know, you think about them and then think, well, what do I want to do in our education as a response to it? But I don't think anybody can deny that it's very difficult to read if people are talking to you. And it's even difficult to read if other people are talking. Pardon?
That does not mean that you're less social. It just means that...
I was just talking about amount of time spent in social interaction and the fact that when you're reading, it's really hard while you're reading to interact socially. That's really all that this was about. Well, I think you're really asking, why did I use a 1965 study in Nigeria here in San Francisco in 2011? And the answer is, the question was about cross-cultural, the relevance of cross-cultural data for us. The reason is it was a natural experiment because everybody's learning to read here, and so we couldn't get this kind of information here that was the reason why I presented it. Yeah, I think we're finished. Oh, one more?
Did they draw any conclusions about Portugal versus Brazil?
You know, that's interesting. The question was, did they draw any conclusions about Portugal versus Brazil? They did not. They did not even mention it. They were neuroscientists, not cross-cultural psychologists or anthropologists. But I was wondering about that, too, because it seemed like... I do have an idea. Do you remember sometimes the Portuguese group were not doing as well as the Brazilian group? And that could be because Portugal being in Europe and Brazil being Brazil in South America, that in Europe, almost everybody learns to read, just like in the United States. If you don't learn to read here, you know, there's a lot else going on. And that's one reason we use cross-cultural data for this kind of thing, because not reading has different meaning in our society where reading is almost universal. And so maybe it was that, but in Brazil is more a developing country, and probably it's more like Mexico, especially like the indigenous parts of Mexico, where it could be perfectly normal still not to learn to read. And so it might be it was a more selected, negatively selected group in Portugal than in Brazil, but they say absolutely nothing. And it would be, I think, very interesting because it's interesting. They didn't combine the two groups. You know, they kept them all separate in their data analysis. I would think they would have been better off to put them together and not have that question be raised. And I think it would have come out just the same. Yeah. Should we finish? We can talk informally afterwards also.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.